You're listening to an audio module from BMJ Learning.
I'm Dr. Phil Zack, a clinical editor at BMJ Learning. In this audio module, we'll look at the diagnosis and management of Tourette syndrome in primary care. In the studio with me is Suzanne Dobson, Chief Executive of Tourette's Action. Hello, Suzanne.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. So, Suzanne, could we start off by just explaining what is Tourette syndrome?
Okay. Tourette syndrome is an inherited neuropsychiatric disease, which is classically identified by motor and vocal tics.
Right, OK. And how common is Tourette syndrome, do we think?
Well, we know from all the peer-reviewed research that 1% of the school-age population has Tourette's. Now, obviously, that isn't identifiable by walking down the street. And so we think that probably about 30% of that 1%. So in the UK, we're maybe looking at 40, 50,000 people have Tourette's to a level where it would require trip to the GP and maybe affects people's lives.
So how does it generally affect people, and what's the range of effects of Tourette syndrome?
Okay, well, the problem with Tourette syndrome is it's a really wide-ranging syndrome, and it does what we call wax and wane, and it does change, so it's really hard to grasp. But somebody with very mild Tourette's might just have a small sniff or little throat clear, and maybe shrug a shoulder or blink or make a strange mouth movement. And then you go to the other extreme, where people make very loud noises. They shout words, or they bark, or they whistle, and they have really expansive tics. So they'll be throwing an arm out or banging their head towards the table. So a whole sliding scale of tics to diagnose.
And what's the sort of time course of this typically? What age does it start at, and how does it tend to progress?
Well, we know it's an inherited condition of genetic origin. So I guess by saying that, you've always got it if you've got it. But typically, children first start to exhibit symptoms that are recognisable between 5 and 7. We know it tends to get worse around puberty and change of school. So 13 seems to be quite a high point for tics. And then for 50% of the people who have Tourette syndrome, their tics will begin to abate as they approach 18, 19, 20. But of course, that does mean that for 50% of the other people, they keep them into adulthood. Along with all of the neurological conditions, Tourette syndrome affects 3 times as many boys as girls.
And the people in whom it abates, does that go away completely usually, or can it come back at periods of stress in their life, for example?
Periods of stress will often trigger it off, but by and large, the tics reduce to a manageable level. Scientifically, nobody's figured out quite why. And a lot of people think that it's actually a sort of self-taught cognitive behaviour therapy, that they've actually just learnt to manage their tics better.
Right. And so is it a condition where people seem to inherit just a predisposition to it, or is it inherited in a clear dominant recessive sex-linked kind of way?
No, it's nothing so simple, I'm afraid. It could just be great Auntie Maud was slightly odd. And now the child has Tourette's, often linked within the family, though, to things like OCD. So if perhaps a grandparent or an aunt had severe OCD, it would not be unreasonable for the child to have Tourette syndrome.
So you've mentioned obsessive compulsive disorder. Are there other conditions which are associated with Tourette syndrome?
Yeah, well, along with obsessive compulsive disorder, there's attention deficit disorder in its various guises. And they do tend to go hand in hand. Some 80% will have a comorbidity of some sort. About 30 or 35% will have OCD, similar number ADHD. And there are also links to the autistic spectrum as well.
Are there any other characteristics which are typical of Tourette syndrome?
that the characteristics which are absolutely typical are the tics, but I think some of the side effects are different. And also, from a point of view of diagnosing Tourette's, the fact that people with Tourette's, and especially youngsters with Tourette's, can suppress for short periods of time their tics. And so often when they present in the GP surgery, mum or dad is telling you about the strange activities and movements that their child is making, but you're not seeing that because the child is suppressing those tics and waiting till they get outside to release them. And that's exactly what happens in school. They suppress them for a while and then the tics come back twice as bad. It's a bit like you trying to suppress a sneeze, I guess, and eventually when the sneeze comes, it's often louder than it would have been if you'd sneezed in the first instance, and that's just a taster of how suppressing a tic works.
Will young people tend to suppress the tics because they're embarrassed or because they... What?
Mixture of things. If it's mild tics they're suppressing, then it will be because they want to be like their peers. They don't want to be different. They're not quite sure what's wrong with them because, of course, they're doing something that comes naturally to them. So they're not quite sure why everyone's causing such a fuss about their blinking or ticking. For other children, they're actually going to do physical damage to themselves. If you have a child whose tic is to throw their head back suddenly, they will do damage to the neck and the muscles of the shoulders. If you have a child whose tic is to repeatedly rub an eye socket, the risk of making themselves blind or have sight problems, breaking down bones, is huge. And so that's why, one of the reasons why it's so important is that the tics of themselves are just, I guess, aggravating, but actually the manifestation of them can be painful and occasionally dangerous.
Right. So, Suzanne, moving on to diagnosis. What are the typical symptoms of Tourette's which you would use to diagnose it?
The typical symptoms to diagnose it are vocal and motor tics. So a motor tic can be eye blinking, it can be grimacing of the mouth, it can be nodding or shrugging or moving an arm or an elbow, fiddle fingering or playing games. And phonic tics can range from a sniff to shouting out loud words, making animal noises, whistling, barking like a dog. And for 10% of people with Tourette syndrome, they will have coprolalia, which is the uncontrollable swearing, which is really a bit difficult. I think a lot of people think that swearing goes hand in hand with Tourette syndrome, but it is only 10% of the people with Tourette syndrome. So if you have a patient who has motor and vocal tics, but they're not swearing, the likelihood is that they have Tourette syndrome.
So, Suzanne, the diagnostic criteria from the DSM-IV-R, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, as it's called. Of course, we're not dealing with a mental illness here, but it is diagnosed on based on the DSM criteria. What are those criteria?
The criteria mainly are that you have motor and vocal tics for at least a year, and that's the very bottom line of the diagnosis. Beyond that, of course, then you get into family history and likelihood.
And within an individual, do the tics tend to be consistent?
They tend to be consistent for a while, so they're unlikely to change within a consultation period. But by the time a referral has happened, they may well be doing different tics, or they may have added tics to their repertoire. Tics are also auto-suggestible. And so somebody with Tourette's has no, what I would call, a social barrier. And so if they see a fat woman on the bus, they're likely to have a tic that says fat woman. If it's a bald man, they're likely to shout out baldy. And that is one of the most difficult social sides of Tourette's is the inability to filter those thoughts that you shouldn't say out loud.
Yeah. So just to recap, according to the DSM criteria for Tourette's, it's motor and vocal tics for at least a year. But during that minimum year period, people can have up to 2 or 3 months when they're tic free.
Yes, because tics wax and wane all the time throughout life and moments of stress, it would be unreasonable to think that it was a straight line. So if the child stops doing it for a while, but then starts again doing exactly the same thing, then it's probably still Tourette's.
Okay. So what other conditions can look similar to Tourette's that doctors ought to differentiate?
Well, the comorbidities that come with it, obviously the autistic spectrum disorders. As you know, they're associated with movements and some noises. But I think with Tourette's, it's the duality, the two types of tic, the motor and the vocal tic happening together, are much more clearly defined than autism. Obviously, at the edges, there are going to be some crossover, and I think that's where it's important to refer to a consultant who spends their whole day doing this.
And speaking of vocal problems, what about stammering?
Stammering isn't related to Tourette's. It's a motor and a phonic tic. Occasionally, people might have trouble getting their words out, but it's very different to stammering as a long-term condition. Some of the other neurological conditions, of course, have movements associated with them. Dystonia is much more of a movement disorder.
So really, just to summarise, with Tourette's, you usually have the motor and vocal tics together in the same patient.
That's absolutely important.
Yes. You said there can be some overlap with the motor and separate vocal tics of people with autism.
Yes.
And that with the primarily motor problems, such as dystonias or, for example, Huntington disease, those usually just have motor manifestations and not the verbal disorders.
That's right.
Okay, thank you. And if a GP suspects that a child or a young person has Tourette's, what sort of referral should they make?
I think they need to make a referral to a specialist, either a neurologist or a clinical psychologist. There are a few all around the country who actually specialise in Tourette's syndrome, and that would be the ideal place to send them. But any neurologist or clinical psychologist should be able to go for the next stage.
And so what is the next stage? What should a GP tell the patient or their parent to expect when they go to have the diagnosis made or confirmed?
Well, the first diagnosis will be quite a long appointment. I think it's worth knowing that before they go, because the clinician will be taking quite a long family history and also quietly observing the child over a longer period to see how the vocal and motor tics are progressing. So I think that's key. I think that's something that people were quite surprised about, how long the appointment is.
And I presume there wouldn't be any investigations that would normally be arranged at that time.
No, certainly that first appointment will be observational, family history. Even in the long term, it's unlikely that you will have head scans or other MRI or CT scans.
So moving on to the management of people with Tourette syndrome, what are the treatment modalities for Tourette's?
I think it's best to say right from the beginning, there is no single treatment. There is currently no cure. There are a range of medications that perhaps the consultant might prescribe to the child, but depending on age, probably not. Overall, for Tourette syndrome, there are three areas. There are medications, but they're medications that are commonly used to treat other conditions, so clonidine, haloperidol, aripiprazole, but due to the side effects, they're often unsuccessful, and often people reject them because they don't like the side effects.
What are the therapeutic effects of those drugs, if they are going to be helpful?
The therapeutic effects are to minimise the tics. So if somebody has a particularly self-damaging tic, it may be worth considering treatment, because it will stop other conditions forming. But people report feeling lethargic. Many people put on weight. They describe it like being under a wet blanket. And therefore, if their tics aren't physically harmful, many people prefer not to go on to medication. A few people are interested in deep brain stimulation, which, of course, has been used for Parkinson's for some time, but really hasn't been used successfully for Tourette's syndrome. A few cases have had deep brain stimulation in the UK, and half of them have had some success, and the other half, I think, feel that either no change or perhaps they're worse off than before. Ongoing studies, but that really isn't a direction that we would go in at all. The most effective treatment for Tourette syndrome is cognitive behaviour therapy, habit reversal therapy.
So how does that work?
Well, when the patient is old enough, so it's not helpful in young children, to recognise the promontory urges, the urge to sneeze, then you can teach yourself to do a competing response. So if, for instance, your vocal tic is to shout out loud, if you feel you're going to shout and you pull your chin down onto your chest, it's pretty impossible to shout. If you punch yourself very hard as one of your motor tics, the competing response would be to make the same movement but with much more control. So you would put your hand on the same part of your body, but far more gently. But in order for habit reversal therapy to work, you need to recognise the promontory urge. So certainly the current thinking is that children under 11 don't recognise it at all. And it's definitely better for older patients who are in more control of their thought processes and their bodies. But the research around the world shows that habit reversal therapy is more successful than any medication in controlling Tourette syndrome.
And typically, how long will people have a course of treatment for?
The research that has been done was for 12 one-hour sessions of cognitive behaviour therapy. Clinicians tell me they think 8 would be a reasonable number to bring about the same effect, but the research says 12.
And that's one a week?
Yes, roughly.
Okay, yes.
The big difficulty, of course, in the UK is that there are very few cognitive behaviour therapists to refer patients to. The number's growing, so it may be more of an option in the future.
And what about patients may think of alternative treatments?
Patients try all sorts of alternative treatments. At the moment, we at Tourette's Action have a trial of weighted blankets that are often used for autism sufferers to try and control tics while people are asleep. Yoga, meditation, relaxation, anything that calms you down. If stress exacerbates your tics, then being calm will moderate your tics.
So, Suzanne, any final comments?
I think, finally, I would like to really stress the importance of diagnosis to the patient. It's not going to make a huge difference in that you can't cure them and you can't make Tourette's go away. But what you can do is enable a patient to understand why they're doing these things, to maybe allow them to consider whether they do want to go down the medication route, to certainly try and get them access to cognitive behaviour therapies to manage their Tourette's. Tourette's is all about management. Unmanaged Tourette's destroys people's lives. Certainly, those who go on into adulthood with it tend to be unemployed. They tend to have physical problems that their tics have brought about joint damage mainly, and certain physical harm, scratching, that brings about infections and other issues going forward. So that first diagnosis is absolutely key, whether it's a young child whose parents don't understand what's going on, or even if it's somebody older who just doesn't know why they're doing these things. That diagnosis unlocks so many areas for them.
Many thanks to you, Suzanne Dobson. For useful resources, follow the links on the next page. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this audio module from BMJ Learning.